Paramedics, my name's Ross. Thank you to the committee for offering me this opportunity to share about, what is it, Arnie? Being of service, supporting the fellowship, supporting ourselves, step 10, 11, and 12. I'm just going to tell my story. Maybe some of that will come out in it. The main topic I get out of that is selfless service. I'm here because a lot of other people did service before I got here. That means a lot to me now. I might not have known it when I got here. I guess I'll get to service a little later, but none of it really means much, I don't think, unless you kind of know where I came from. So I'll cover where I came from as quickly as I can. It was a long, sordid story. And I can scrunch it up into about 5 minutes, I hope. Home where there were a lot of secrets. I was the youngest. And the secrets were between my older siblings and my parents, and there were a lot of things just not talked about. But I think children are extraordinarily sensitive. I think I was probably more sensitive than I realized at the time, but subconsciously I got that. There was stuff going on that I didn't know about. It had to do with shame, it had to do with sexuality, it had to do with things that we're not allowed to talk about. So I grew up in an atmosphere where we didn't really talk about stuff much. I became good at keeping secrets myself. I picked up in my teens and used for 25 years. And it was fun at first. This was a while ago. I'm an old guy, eh? This was during the 60s. And it was easy to pick up in the 60s. It was everywhere. And it was, if I don't know, I was just attracted to the Jimi Hendrix and the Cream. And they were my people. And I was part of that, taking lots of experimental drugs. And it was kind of a spiritual journey at first. I mean, that's what I thought it was. It just kind of veered off into left field at a certain point. At a certain point, it stopped being a spiritual journey, and part of my identity. I started waking up in the morning, and the first thing I thought of was, how am I going to get high today? And I didn't think that was abnormal. It was just the way I was living. It was just who I was. I guess I can exemplify it pretty well by kind of giving a brief biography of my daughter, actually. When the night my daughter was born, I was junk sick. And I borrowed without permission some money and went out and got myself not junk sick. The sad part of that is that it poisoned forever probably the most amazing event that had ever happened in my life. Now when I think of the night this miracle happened when my daughter was born, my addiction is right there. And it's not something I'm proud of. And over the years, there's some memories of her growing up. She's 4 years old. And she's holding on my leg, and she's facing her mother down and saying, "He doesn't always lie, Mommy." And I was looking down at her, and I was thinking, well, I do, actually. And I used behind that, too. I didn't like myself much. I was doing stuff that I didn't approve of. I left her in a taxi when I went to school. It was fifth step stuff. But it's important for me to remember these things because it's where my addiction took me. It was like I didn't care. That was the power that the drugs had. And I sometimes put a hypothetical question to myself. You know, when I was on a run, if I'd had a choice between like pushing a button, which knocked off all the people that I love in the world, and getting my next fix, I don't know what I would have decided to do. So, you know, it wasn't pretty. And I did not know about Narcotics Anonymous. This was before it was really a widespreadly available program. This was in Montreal, and I guess I went to a couple of treatment centers, because not because I wanted to, but because I wanted to fool some people into thinking I wanted to. Until finally I got arrested on Christmas Eve. And I'd been collecting, in those days, I don't know what happens now, I haven't been arrested in quite a while. In those days, you get, usually, when I got arrested, because it happened a lot, they'd give you this thing, and you'd have to show up in court, like 3 or 4 months later, and then they'd send you on your way, after you'd been through the whole handcuff thing. This was, you know, not shoplifting, it's not a big deal. By this particular time, Christmas Eve, they decided that they wanted to know that somebody else in the world knew me and knew about this thing that was happening to me. So they got me to divulge. I was living in my parents' basement at the time. My wife had kicked me out, and I was living in my parents' basement. So they were the only people, but I knew the phone number besides my dealer. And they phoned them on Christmas Eve and told them that I'd been arrested, and did they know me? And they said, yes. And then they let me go, and I came home, and by the time I got there, I had my story straight. I'd lost my wallet. Somebody had, you know, when I was confronted about the fact that the police had called, I guess I'd lost my wallet and somebody else had it and had been arrested, and that's why it didn't work. I guess they'd gotten to know me by then. So it's Christmas Eve, and this is a family meeting time because my sister's in from Colorado, my brother's in town, everybody's in town, and I am the topic of conversation. And the choice was offered to me at that point that I could volunteer to go into a long-term treatment program, or they never wanted to see me again. And in my mind, that wasn't really what I was thinking about. I was thinking about this, you know, thick deck of summonses that I had hidden in the drawer, and how it might look better when I finally had to face the music if I had been to treatment and it could tell somebody that I was trying to deal with this problem, which I didn't really regard as a problem. It was denial. So I picked option A. It's hard, I guess, for parents to tell their kids that they never want to see them again. I didn't realize until later how hard that choice was. My mom told me later that it was the first time she'd ever seen my dad cry. It was later that night. I was kind of oblivious to that part of things at that time. So I came to from Montreal to here, and arrived here with a garbage bag full of my old clothes and stuff, and went to treatment, and they made me go to Narcotics Anonymous meetings. And I wasn't very interested in Narcotics Anonymous because just before I left Montreal, I called my dealer and told her to save me some. I'll be back. So I wasn't like here full of willingness and I want to start a new life. I was going to effing treatment, and I don't want to. That I guess I have to. And I didn't like any of you guys. You were all, losers that couldn't handle their dope, you know, not like me. I could handle my dope. Haven't I demonstrated that? I was carrying a lot of self-loathing, to say the least. And as I said, I didn't like anybody here, but over time, I mean, it was a 6-month program, and they made me stay 9. And over that time, something happened, and it wasn't so much. I think treatment is a real good place for somebody like me, because it gave me a safe place to just be alive. I don't remember much that happened there, but the main thing that they did for me was they introduced me to you guys. And even though I didn't like you at first, I learned to love you later. I went to one of our Narcotics Anonymous activities here. There was a dance. I was 3 or 4 months clean. And this person, not like today, but I was completely enveloped in shame. I hated myself, and I didn't think anybody else thought much more of me than I did. So I slunk around, I went to these things, I went to these meetings, I didn't talk much, I didn't want to be here, but I went to this activity because, oh hell, what else is there to do? And there's some pretty girls there. Anyway, one of these pretty girls was standing on a ladder with some balloons, and she was hanging up the balloons. And I always tell this story because it's kind of iconic in my recovery story. She handed me these balloons and asked me to help put them up. And at that moment, it was, in my mind, it was like, do you know who I am? Like, you're asking me, like, you're including me? You want me to be a part of this? You're asking me to be a part of this? I don't deserve to be alive, much less participate in this event, and to help you put up colored balloons around the place. You're getting me confused with somebody else. But that being included made me want to stay. I hung up some balloons. I felt like I belonged there. I thought, okay, I can do this. I'm going to hang up balloons, I guess. And I did. And I don't know if I became a member of Narcotics Anonymous right there at that moment, but I sort of did. Something clicked inside. Something like hope. Something like, I don't have to carry this. Like, apparently, other people are willing to let me be around and participate in these events, so fine. About 7 months later, I became a member. I wasn't a member when I got here, obviously. And it says in our literature that the membership is not automatic. It certainly wasn't for me. It was a process for me. But once I realized that I had somehow become a member of Narcotics Anonymous, everything that happened here started to matter a lot more. I started going to business meetings. I started to pay attention, because I certainly had as a lot of us do, I was very suspicious of authority. And I thought, I associated Narcotics Anonymous with them, and you were going to manipulate me into being Lord knows what. I was going to be brainwashed into being something that I didn't want to be. So I wanted to know where the money was going. And I wanted to know who was deciding things. I wouldn't trust anybody. So I started going, you know, that's how I got involved in business meetings. But ultimately, I mean, I became a G GSR when I was 9 months clean, and I think, okay, I got clean in 88, and I've had some kind of active service position since then. And it's just part of my life. It's, and people sometimes think I overdo it. I don't overdo it. One at a time, please. You know, and I'm not kind of involved in absolutely everything that happens. But something. I was involved in something. And I sometimes say to myself, well, you know, I'll stop working for Narcotics Anonymous when Narcotics Anonymous stops working for me. So far, so good. So you're stuck with me, unfortunately, because as long as the program keeps working for me, I'm going to keep participating in keeping the doors open. My deepest belief is that service is an act of love. It is an act of love for people we haven't met yet. It is an act of love handing some balloons to somebody who doesn't think they deserve to live, and to make them feel like they belong somewhere. And all of our service, no matter what it is, if we're putting on a convention, if we're printing a meeting list, that's the motivation which our literature says is that's what it's about. It's a concept which was completely foreign to me in 1988. I was doing it to save my life. I was getting involved because people told me to. Because if you get involved, stay involved, you'll meet people, other people who are involved and who are probably working some kind of program. And I've certainly been at lots of meetings which didn't feel like there was a lot of that love was what it was actually about. I've been at a lot of meetings where somebody had to stand up and say, how does this help the newcomer? And bring it back to earth. Because ultimately that's what all our efforts are supposed to be about. I've had the honor. My understanding of the service structure is sort of like the inverted pyramid. Most people have heard of this one. In the hierarchy, so to speak, we don't have any presidents, but we have. So at the more deeply involved you get, so you can be involved at the group level, which is the highest form of service, at the group, and then the area, which is slightly further down, and then at the very bottom, it's not that you're more important than anybody else, it's just that you have that many more bosses. The bosses we have are at the top of the pyramid. Those are the members in the groups. And gradually you get further and further away from them, but you're more responsible. You're responsible to more people. And it's easy on those. I've been at the areas, I've been at region, I've been at the Canadian Assembly, and I've attended the World Service Conference, and I've always tried to remind myself that it's because most of us have some ego somewhere, and it's really important for me to try to remember. I'm getting singles. I'm not more important because I'm at the World Service Conference. I have that much more responsibility because I'm at the World Service Conference. For addicts who have ego problems, sometimes that's difficult. It's been an amazing journey. And I don't talk about these different levels of service because I think it makes me any. They've all given me huge gifts. They've all added to my appreciation of Narcotics Anonymous. I actually realize how spoiled I am having grown up in Ottawa. In Ottawa, we have meetings every day. two or three, four meetings every single day. And it hasn't always been like that. In 1988, it wasn't like that, but it's become easy to find Narcotics Anonymous. It's become easy here to stay involved in Narcotics Anonymous. There are places where we're trying to carry the message where it's illegal to have meetings. There's places around the world where we're trying to carry the message now, so people who we don't know yet can find the gift of recovery. It's a wonderful privilege to be a part of that in a small way sometimes. That was a while ago. I haven't done service at that level in about 10 years. I'm a GSR for my home group now. That's my elected position today. And it keeps me involved. I hope I never lose the desire to be of service in Narcotics Anonymous. I guess I added steps 10, 11, and 12 here. So I run out of talking about service because I can go on only so long about it. You know, I just run completely out of steam talking about service. 10, 11, 12. I guess it's important for me, it was sort of what I was talking about, reminding ourselves that it's not about me, it's about people who weren't here yet. That's why I'm doing the work that I'm doing. And I did put basic text somewhere. Hold me a second. I had to go home. I'm at an NA convention, I had to go home to find a basic text. We read this at every area meeting in Ottawa, and it's one of my favorite readings in the basic text. It's the first paragraph of Tradition 2, first two paragraphs. In Narcotics Anonymous, we are concerned with protecting ourselves from ourselves. Our second tradition is an example of this. By nature, we are strong-willed, self-centered people who are thrust together in NA. We are mismanagers, and not one of us is capable of consistently making good decisions. In Narcotics Anonymous, we rely on a loving God as he expresses himself in our group conscience, rather than on personal opinion or ego. I just love that, saving ourselves from ourselves, because that's what's for me. I often think that there's really two aspects to service. I didn't want to forget this. I think the work we do is really important. Starting meetings in countries where it hasn't started yet. But almost of equal importance is what happens to us as recovering people as we're doing the work. Before I got here, we had business meetings in cars deciding who was going to drive the getaway car, right? That was our business meetings. And I got here and I was introduced to Robert's rules and how to make decisions without being disagreeable. And I didn't know about budgets, and I didn't know about group conscience. I didn't know about how to be accountable. All of these skills I have learned through doing service in Narcotics Anonymous. And all of us who get involved learn to some degree this stuff. Some of us come with those skills already. I certainly did not. And I can go to meetings elsewhere, not in Narcotics Anonymous, and I don't feel out of place because I've been here. I've learned how to speak respectfully. I've learned how to listen to other people. And that's a gift from you guys, utterly and completely. So yeah, there's the work we do, but I think it's kind of like a safe lab where we can learn skills which allow us to participate in society. And to me, it's almost an equal balance. Narcotics Anonymous offers these opportunities. And it's said that 2% of us do all the service. That's too bad. Because some of us end up taking on too much. Some of us run away with resentments because we're doing all the work and nobody else is doing it. There's a lot of stuff goes on like that. If everybody pulled their weight a little bit, then there'd be less for everybody, of course. I'm about done. 2 years ago, my daughter visited Montreal, and well, she came here first, and we went to Montreal together. And I went to visit her and her sister and her mom, and it was in this. It was a really nice. Like I'm not part of that family anymore. Just my daughter, but I was visiting with her and her sisters and stuff, and I was kind of filled with a. Yeah, I wasn't jealous. It was just. I was really happy for her to have this really strong family around her. And I mentioned it to her. I said, "You've got a really great team here," you know, about her sisters and her mom and how they were supporting her. And she just had a baby. I'm a granddad now. And she poked me in the chest and said, "Dad, I got a really good team right here." And thank you guys for that. I wasn't a good team 20 years ago. But you've allowed me to grow into someone that my daughter can respect. Fancy that. I'm grateful for the balloons. I'm grateful for the steps. And I'm about to be grateful for Arnie's message. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ross. Our second speaker is Arnie from Toronto. Please help me welcome Arnie.
My name's Arnie, I'm an addict.
Arnie.
Welcome to, Ross, you took the topic away. Welcome to this workshop on relationships. No, being of service, good. I'm always talking about the wrong thing. I wanna thank the Academy, all the little people that made this possible. Now I wanna thank the committee for allowing me to be of service and to come here and share. Thank my wife for letting me come here, letting me run away from home. I want to thank Ross for just being the human being that he is. Ross is very humble. Ross was chair of the Canadian Assembly for a long time. And we served together there, and it was just one of those great learning experiences. For me, that I will come back to. This is a service workshop, clearly. And whenever you're at a convention and they have a service workshop, generally you could call any other workshops that are going on anything other than service, because that's where people are going to go. Very rarely people come and show up for. If it's got the word service in it, generally people don't show up. So I really appreciate. The fact that there's anybody at all in the room. That's fantastic. That's a good sign. But it also shows the very small amount of people that actually do service, that are interested in service, that even want to know about service. I think a lot of people put their fingers in their ears and just say, well, somebody else will do that. And people sitting in this room know that somebody else will not necessarily do that. That somebody has to get their ass up out of the chair and do it. And you're the people that do it. Thank you for setting it up, Ross. I'll tell my story. Tell a service story. Let's see. You know what? I was 13. I got loaded. I passed out. I woke up. I was 38. And that's basically it, you know? I didn't want to come to Narcotics Anonymous. I didn't think this was a good idea. This was just the most absurd thing that anyone could ever suggest to me. I'd been exposed to Narcotics Anonymous before. I'd seen you guys in the treatment centers and the detoxes that I had been to. and I didn't want any part of it. You with your group hugs and your keep coming back and your little group readings. And the last treatment center I went to, I lasted 5 days in Los Angeles, and it was interesting. I learned so much. I learned, back then, different things appealed to me. They put me in a room, and they told me that, they asked me if I was hungry. Now, I'd been up for 7 days, and I hadn't eaten, I hadn't slept, I hadn't done anything in seven, well, I'd done a lot of stuff in 7 days, but it certainly didn't have anything to do with food. So I said, yes, I'm hungry. I said, well, right across the hallway, and I could see this glass wall, was an area where all of you were sitting in the cafeteria with your food. And I said, yeah, I'm not hungry. I'm not going there. Because I was looking at all the differences, none of the similarities. I wanted to stay as far away from there as possible. So they brought food to the room in this particular treatment center. And I had a couple of other gentlemen in the room. fascinating gentleman. There was a huge fellow. His name was Lamar. He was 20 feet tall. He was very big. He was a crackhead. He was hyperactive. He was everything, and everybody was scared of him because he threatened everybody. Him and I just got along like this. And there was another older fellow there who was like old, very old, and he called me Steve till the day we left, and I don't know why. But he would often, in the treatment center, this is the way it worked. At night, the lights would go down, we'd go out, we'd steal food. They'd say, you gotta come to the meetings during the day, and we'd go, yeah, right. And we'd be smoking by the window. We never left the room. The elderly guy would go out at night and steal furniture from the hotel, and when I woke up, the room would be redecorated. So we'd have an armoire from a doctor's office on the seventh floor, and we'd have all this. And that's kind of the way it went in treatment for a long time. Well, a long time for me, which was 4 days. And then I realized it was clear, it dawned on me on the fifth day that I haven't used in 5 days. I have not used in 5 days. And they said I was an addict. I haven't used in 5 days. Clearly, this thing works. And so I decided that it was time for me to leave. I booked a meeting with the head of the facility, and I said, I think I should be able to leave. I thought all the doors were locked, and she said, the doors aren't locked here. And that was just a revelation to me. And then I couldn't figure out, well, why are we here? Why isn't everybody just running away? And she said, the doors aren't locked. You can leave whenever you need to. Thank you. But I haven't finished yet. The doors aren't locked, and I had to tell her that I had to let her know something that was, I thought, well, I was the only person who knew, which was, there are a lot of drug addicts in here. She said, really? I said, yes, a lot of drug addicts. Some of them are crazy. I don't belong here. I think I should go. So after five days, I left, and of course, I was operating on Arnie's Anonymous, great program, one step, willingness, doesn't work. And I got high over and over and over again until eventually I found the program. And I found the program not because I wanted to, it was because of the state of California felt that it was important that I go to meetings. I had to have a piece of paper signed. If you have a problem with court cards, don't, because it saved my life. I went to a meeting when I didn't want to go to a meeting. When I told my lawyer, she said, the choice is you go back to jail or you go to a meeting. I would have much preferred to go to jail at that point, but I went to the meeting, and I went to the meeting, and I didn't expect what I was going to see. I didn't expect what I was going to hear. I didn't expect what I was going to feel at the meeting, and I didn't want to see, and I didn't want to hear, and I didn't want to feel. I didn't want to be a part of that. I didn't want to be a part of you. I didn't want anything you had. I didn't want to grow up like you. I didn't want to get old like you. I didn't want to look like you. I didn't want to smell like you. I didn't want to do anything that you did. But I went into that meeting, and I heard the stuff I didn't want to hear, and I saw what I didn't want to see. And I saw that there were people who were just like me. One guy looked like he crawled out from under a rock, but he was clean. And it changed my life. That meeting changed my life because I saw the truth. And the truth is that you don't have to use anymore. That's the truth. And the funny thing about the truth is that when you see the truth, you can't make it go away. You can't unsee the truth. I didn't see that. That never happened. I saw it. I saw it with my own eyes. I went back to the crack house I was living in, and I told them, you should see where I've been. And I stayed clean for about a half an hour. But I had to go back again. I had to go back again. I had to go back again, and I couldn't get that out of my head. I knew that there was a solution. So it took me a while, even though I was exposed to meetings, to finally make that break. I came back up to Canada, and then I went to treatment. Not to say that treatment is everything and treatment's what you need to do, but I went to treatment because I wanted to go to treatment. What time are we going to? Oh, awesome. Isn't that great? You want to talk about service for another 2 days? I went to treatment because I wanted to go to treatment. I really wanted to go. I really wanted recovery. I got into a meeting. I got a home group. I started hearing people talk a different language at the meetings, and I asked them where they got that. They said, I've got a sponsor. What's a sponsor? We talked about that. I asked somebody to be my sponsor. They said no, and I didn't exactly know what to do with that, but someone said, you know, if your dealer said no, you wouldn't stop doing drugs, and they were right, so I asked somebody else. And my first exposure, once I got back to Canada and really started going to meetings, I had a home group. It was the Nooner in Vancouver. It was the Nooner. And someone told me when I got there, if you can stay clean in the Nooner, you can stay clean anywhere. Nooners are generally an interesting group of people. Nooners are generally people who are not employed. And you really get a cross-section of society. There is every opportunity to look for the differences in a Nooner. If you really want to go somewhere where it may be difficult to see the similarities, go to the Nooner. But you know, I knew at this point I crossed that line where I didn't have any other choices. I tried lots of other things before I got here. I had tried counselors. Who suggested that I stop using drugs? Ridiculous. I had tried. I tried religion. I tried. You know, I shared with some people in the room before. I've tried putting my hands on the television at 2 a.m. when the evangelist was there and crying, and he's crying, I'm crying, and didn't work. So I tried everything, and here's where I ended up. This was the last stop before the bus went over the cliff. And I got a home group. I got a home group. The Nooner. New attitudes in Vancouver. Noon, every day. It was about 2 blocks from where I was living in someone's basement with, who was kind enough to let me live in their basement, I should say, light bulb hanging from the ceiling, but it was, you know what, it was a palace. It was the best. And I think in some ways I'm jealous of newcomers because it's just the best time because there's so much stuff coming in. There's so much new stuff to learn. There's so much, somebody says, keep coming back. You go, wow, where'd you get that? Keep coming back. That's what it was like for me, and I got messages from everywhere. You know, I was looking at nature, I was watching TV, and everything was talking to me and telling me what direction I should go in. But I kept going to the Nooner, this day after day after day after day. And that's where I first saw service. That's where I first saw people involved in service. We had a fellow there who was a secretary. And and we had a chairperson. I knew that, that's all I knew, is that we had those two people. And the chair would generally run the meeting, the secretary would kind of take over the middle. Well, this, and the secretary would hand out the readings and everybody would read them. Not this secretary. The secretary read every meeting. That was, when he was secretary, he read all the, and he was a terrible reader. But he would read all the readings, and so I got my first resentment towards service. At one point the secretary didn't show up. At one point the secretary didn't come to the meeting. And they said, Arnie, you're going to be the secretary. And they gave me the sheets for the secretary, and I got to be the secretary. It was really something. And they said, you know, we have the business meeting once a month, and you should come, you should show up. And I got to go to the business meeting. And it was, like Ross was saying, it was very exciting because I got to see behind the curtain what's going on with Narcotics Anonymous. And I was voted in as a secretary for my home group. And I had a title and I had a position. And new people would arrive at the meeting. And say, what's your name? I'm glad you're here. This is great. I'm the secretary, by the way. You may have heard of me. I'm a pretty big deal around the Nooner. So, you know, but it gave me a sense of, and we were talking about it in the car on the way up. And thank you, Joe, for getting us here safely and swiftly and heavy on the swiftly. But it's great. But we were talking about that on the way up in the car, that service is about a sense of purpose. It's about a sense of belonging. The program became my program. The home group became my home group. Welcome to, it's not the program, welcome to our program. So anyways, I got to go to the business meeting and we were, we were talking about, once again, like Ross was saying, the money, like we get to decide on what we're gonna do. I had a voice, I got to vote. And I look back on it now, it was probably the most dysfunctional thing I've ever seen. But to me then, this was like I was in the House of Commons. I was in the United Nations. This was a big deal. Well, we've got $10 from the seventh tradition. What should we do with it? Wow! How are we going to allocate these funds? And, it was very, very, those were exciting times. And that's where I got introduced to a GSR. There was a GSR. Treasure. I didn't even know these people existed. They were like these Secret Service positions that never got to talk at the meeting, but yet they handled the money and they represented us at area. And it was fascinating for me. And I probably could have stayed and done that position for a long time. I probably could have lived out my life as Secretary of the Nooner in Vancouver. But fate pushes us in all sorts of mundane different directions. And as fate would have it, I picked a sponsor when I was in treatment. Clearly the wrong sponsor to pick. I picked him because he had a mohawk and because he was really funny. And I just thought he was a great guy. So I answered the phone one day, and that's another key in service, don't answer the phone. If you don't want to do something, don't answer the phone. It's always answer the phone, what? But you never say no. My sponsor always told me when NA asks, you don't say no. And that's where the good stuff happens. Even when you want to say no, even when you think it's the most mundane, ridiculous thing in the world, don't say no. So I got a call from my sponsor saying, what are you doing on Wednesday night? I made the mistake of saying nothing. He said, great, you're coming in with me. We're going to do some H&I. Never heard of H&I before. I said, great, that's super. And I hung up the phone and go, what the hell is H&I? But I found out, we met him, and we went into, actually, it was sometime later. There was a little bit of a gap between the time that we went into the treatment center. It turned out to be the treatment center that I went through. It turned out that I had 6 months by then. I was writing in my journal that I don't know about this recovery thing. I remember writing that I really don't know where I'm at. I don't know what's going on. I don't think I've learned anything. I don't think anything has changed. I think I wouldn't recognize recovery if it got into an elevator with me. And yet, here I am, and just the same. I want something to change. I want it to happen right now. I want it to be an event. I don't want it to be a process. He said, come on, we're going to do some H&I. We go back into the treatment center that I had been in 6 months beforehand. And we walked in there, and I'm looking at the people who sat in the same chairs that I was sitting in, and were they ever a mess? They were a mess. I realized I was a mess. I've changed. Like, I remember coming out of there thinking, amongst other things, wow, I have changed. This program has changed me. Whether I like it or not, I've been changed. And I didn't even come here to change. I came here to change what I did. I realized to stay here, I have to change who I am. And I didn't know that then. So I went and did H&I, loved it. Loved H&I. Really felt like we were getting in the Blackhawks, going behind enemy lines, dropping down, carrying the message, getting back in the helicopters, getting back to home base, and then talking about how great we were. That was, you said that was great. you see that guy in the corner? Oh, he loved it. He was crying when you were talking about that part. So it was a great experience. So for anybody who hasn't done H&I here, H&I is hospitals and institutions. It's carrying the message into treatment centers, detox, prisons, jails, usually where people can't get out to meetings. And I've had the opportunity over the years to do a lot of H&I. I love doing H&I. H&I is a solution for everything. If there's something going wrong in your life, do some H&I. You back over the dog in your car, do some H&I. You know, your spouse leaves you, do some H&I. You get fired from your job, do some H&I. It's always a way of getting that gratitude back and that appreciation for what's truly important, and to see people who don't have what we have, and to be able to give your life, once again with service, a sense of purpose, a meaning, to do something for someone else that we don't expect anything back from. So I got into this H&I so bad. I mean, it's not surprising I got addicted to H&I, big surprise. So I became a panel leader because, hey, it's the only service position in NA that has the word leader. So I wanted that one, panel leader. I'm the panel leader. I used to be the secretary, now I'm the panel leader. So I go up to, you know, my job was to, you know, go to meetings and you listen to people sharing and go up to them. You know, that was a pretty good message. You ever thought of doing H&I? You might want to come in with me. I did that to someone after a meeting. He was a really, really tall guy, but he spoke really well. And here I had like 9 months later, something like that, and I went up to him and said, you know, you've got a pretty good message. It was Walter. Walter, Ross is laughing because Walter was on the board of trustees for the World Service Office. And here I am with 9 months going, yeah, you got a pretty good message there. What's your name again? Walter, good. Listen, I'm doing a little thing on Wednesdays. You might want to come down. I'll invite you. Just say you're with me. Walter, he was very polite. He said, okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Walter is just a wonderful, warm guy. He's done so much service for this. He was very kind to me not to slap me around. So at any rate, I was a panel leader for a long time. Turns out I was a panel leader, and this is not what you're supposed to do at H&I. I was panel leader at the same facility for 10 years. That's not what you're supposed to do. There's something called rotation. But I didn't do that. However, after being panel leader for a while, you know, and understanding what's going on behind the curtains at the group level by seeing the business meeting there and really telling my friends, wow, you should see what goes on, what we do with the money. Eventually, at a committee meeting for H&I, the chair didn't show up. The chair said he was resigning. And he was resigning right there. He wanted to leave, there was no more chair. So, I'm not going to burp on tape or on CD. That would be great. It was a burp, by the way. So he ended up leaving, and they said, you know, we need a chair. We need a person to take over. And once again, this is one of the things where everybody is looking around, looking at everybody else. And finally, after that silence, I said, like, I'll be the chair. So great, Artie got voted in his chair. So I was chair of H&I in Vancouver for a while, which allowed me to experience for the first time an area meeting. Never been to an area meeting before. That was very interesting. I mean, going from the business meeting at my home group to the area meeting, you know, if I thought that was the House of Commons, now I'm looking at, wow, these people are gods in here. And it was so organized, and even though people were yelling at each other half the time, it was really something to be a part of. And we weren't just dealing with $10, we were dealing with hundreds of dollars. And we were talking about issues that were all over Vancouver. And it was so exciting. And there was the camaraderie of service. You know, there are a group of people, you get clean with them, and they'll always be, you know, I've always got the class of 94 that I got clean with. But then you've got people in who you've done service with, like Ross and I, who've done service together. There's that bond of, you know, we were in the war. We were there. We served in that particular battle for however long. And it's just something, it's just something else. It seems to be another level. And you start seeing these people in service all the time. You see them here. You start going to conventions like this. You see the same faces over and over again. So I served as chair for a while for Vancouver H&I, and then as a result of that, I had to represent Vancouver H&I at something called a region. Now, I'd never been to a region before. It was very exciting. It was in another, we had to drive there. It was like in another city. We actually got the first kind of NA road trip. And then it was like a whole other level. Like we were on this galactic level of service that I couldn't even imagine. And people were polite, and it really was organized. And it was a tight crew. It was very interesting. And I heard things about what was happening all over British Columbia. I heard what was happening. And sometimes I got the trickle down of news on what was happening in the world. What was happening in the whole world? I was getting another, you know, it's like when I was at my home group and you serve as a secretary, you get to go to the business meeting, your vision gets a little farther. You get to see a little farther away on what's on the horizon, where we've been. You get the area, you get to see a little farther on where we're going, how we're going to get there. You get the region, you get to see even farther out where we're going. Those were very, very exciting times. I went to region, I served on the regional H&I subcommittee for a while, and it was fabulous, it was wonderful, great crew, like-minded people. We were all key about H&I. We loved H&I, we loved carrying the message. We did something. We were doing something that made a difference. After a while, I was the vice chair for regional H&I in British Columbia, and then I became the chair for H&I in British Columbia for whatever the terms were. I think it was two years, which was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And I remember when we were sitting at the regional table, I was at region for 12 years. I remember sitting at the regional table, one of the things that we talked about was, is there life after service? Like, what happens? What happens after this position? Go to the next position, because at my regional, at a lot of the regional tables where I went to, a lot of the areas that I went to, it seemed like there were elections and people were just shifting seats. They were just moving around. The treasurer would become a secretary, secretary would become a chair would become this, and it was, I think everybody was afraid to let go of service and move on to some different service. So there was that discussion, is there life after service? And one of the reasons why is we had some people there called RDs. And I got to find out what an RD is. And an RD, for those of you who don't know, is a regional delegate, an individual that carries the message of or is a conduit of information, if you will, and represents the region to the World Service Conference that Ross was talking about. And to hear them talk, to hear what they were saying, and to hear the insight that they had, and the news they were carrying. I wanted that information. I was hungry for information. I was hungry for participation. I wanted to see this stuff. So after I finished, and sorry, the reason why I said life after service, because a lot of these regional delegates were rolling off, and they were lost, and they didn't do service anymore. And I couldn't understand that. And some of the alternates rolled off, and he didn't do service anymore. The alternate position came up, and I was voted in as RD alternate. I was so excited to go to my first World Service Conference, to go to the World Service Conference. This was like going to Oz. I didn't have any idea what to expect. A yellow brick road, a big emerald, you know. I had no idea what to expect. It was so exciting. And I was the alternate. I wasn't the RD, so basically my job was to get copies for the RD. I just made sure he was taken care of, everything was good with him. Did he have a pen? Did he have a coffee? Okay, just tell me what to do. And to go to this event, to go to the World Service Conference, to be able to witness the global demographics of Narcotics Anonymous was something that I can't adequately put into words. But one of the jobs you have as an alternate, one of the jobs you have as a regional delegate is to be able to carry that information back to your region. But it's not just carrying the information. It's carrying that feeling. It's carrying that energy that's so hard to tell them. You should see what I saw. You should have been where I was. I made a PowerPoint presentation to say, this is where these people sit. This is where the translators sit, the translation booths. This is the big screen. This is, you know, this guy's from Peru. This fellow's from Germany. And there was like a list they would put up on the projector when people were waiting to talk. And you'd see, Australia, Africa, all these countries just listed off. That was a continent, sorry. But all these countries listed off that you often had to pinch yourself and say, wow, how did I get here? How did we get here? How did a fellowship that they don't pay us anything to do what we do? How did we get here? By people volunteering their time, by people volunteering all their free time. And the unsung heroes in this are the spouses. The unsung heroes are the ones that let us go. The unsung hero for me today is my wife, who's sitting at home, willingly giving up her husband for a weekend. You know, they get the, of the conventions, you get the guy talking in front of the podium. She gets a guy who comes home tired and has got to go to sleep because he's tired from the convention. So, you know, there's a lot of credibility for them I don't want to leave out. At any rate, I got to go to the conference and witness the conference and become a part of the conference, really begin to see what kind of program we have, what's going on globally, which is a picture that very few people get the opportunity to see. For whatever reason, the communication is very difficult from World Services to a home group, if you will. And that's always, we've always been trying to improve that. However, that being said, alternate RD for a while, then finally became the regional delegate for British Columbia. They were great, great times. Well, what happens after RD? Well, as a matter of fact, serving as an RD, that's where I got the opportunity to meet Ross. Because one of the things the RDs did across Canada is they went to the Canadian Assembly. And the Canadian Assembly is all the regional delegates, all the regions of Canada that get together to try to see how we can carry the message and interact with the government of this country and try to help the fellowship nationally, if you will. And Ross and I, we were roommates at one point. I remember we had some conference calls before Niagara Falls. Strange things can happen in recovery. So serving on the Canadian Assembly, we had some conference calls we'd have to have in meetings over the phone, because we only met one time a year physically. So three of those meetings we had conference calls. And we had, you know, a delegate from British Columbia, a delegate from Alsace, a delegate from Ontario, a delegate from... So on the line was everybody. Now, I didn't know it. There was an alternate Ontario delegate who was on the phone at that point. And this is before we went to Niagara Falls. And, you know, we had the meeting. I don't remember saying anything, but apparently I was a moron, because the alternate from Ontario said, hung up the phone and told her friends that that guy, I can't believe how much I hate that guy. That guy from British Columbia is a moron. And when I see him in Niagara Falls, he's going to get it. We've been married for 11 years now. Just so you know. It was pretty funny. So, yeah, Ross was there. Ross was there, because she was ready to just spank me in public. And we arrived at Niagara Falls, and I got there at 8:30 when it was supposed to start. And Ontario, the host region, was late. And so I was pissed off. And then she walked into the room, and it's one of those NA things, you know, it was all over at that point. It was over, it was done. And we knew it. And, you know, I'm so fortunate. I'm so fortunate to have ended up with it. It's tough when you've got somebody else in the program as a spouse, though, because they start throwing it back at you. yeah, where's Mr. N.A. now? Come on. So, you know, the RD term was coming up. The RD term was winding up. It was time to finish being an RD. I told myself, I am not disappear into the woodwork of Narcotics Anonymous. So I'll get another service position. I'll go back to being an H&I chair or an H&I panel leader. It'd be wonderful to serve out my days in the pasture. However, I was nominated for the World Board. So I said, once again, fine, whatever direction we decide to go in, I'm willing to put my hat in the ring. We had a vote at the Canadian Assembly, we had a vote at the region, and then went to the conference. And what happens for that is the conference, the World Service Conference votes in a board, which is at that time was anywhere up to 18, or actually 24 people, I think, then. And you know, you start thinking that, and at that point in your service career, you want to have your humility, and you want to have your, you know, and you really play it to, you know, whatever happens, happens. It doesn't make any difference to me. I'm just here to serve. But as you get closer and closer to that election, there is this very awkward, awful thing that happens, going, ooh, what if I don't win? What if I don't get in? What if? It was really, really, it was really a conflict, if you will. So, at any rate, they had the vote. They had the vote, and when I saw my name up on the screen, it was hard to believe, and I didn't know what I had signed up for. What I had signed up for is the term for a World Board member is 6 years, and you're eligible for two terms. So I've been on the World Board now for 10 years. I've been the treasurer for 2 years, and I'm currently the vice chair of the World Board. So just service-wise, getting on the board was, and this is something I want to talk about in service, and Ross and I were alluding to this dark side to begin with. There is this concept, and I don't know where it came from. Maybe it's because I'm Canadian. Maybe it's because we're Canadian and we just apologize for everything. And we think that, you know, everything is going to take care of itself. But there is this undercurrent of distrust that happens. And in particular, there was an undercurrent of distrust with World Services. And I just never felt that way. I never felt that way when I was an RD alternate. I never felt that way when I was an RD. I knew the people. Ross and I were there. We knew the people. We knew the people who were representing us. We knew the people who were elected into those positions. And yet there was this underlying distrust. There was a lot of turmoil in Narcotics Anonymous back in the 80s. There was a lot of upheaval. And there are some people who are still around from back then, who, for whatever reason, believe that some of that is, I don't know, still happening. And actually want to believe that, which is even scarier. So the reason why I bring that up is sometimes you have an us and them. One of the things that we try to do on the board is try to get out as much as possible so that, you know, people can see there is no us and them. And all a board member is just a glorified GSR, that's all. And eventually they're off and somebody else steps up. But the reason why I bring it up, because there's an interesting thing that happens at the World Service Conference. When you're serving with all your fellow RDs, we've got stuff we want to talk about, we've got stuff we're getting together, we're writing motions, we're getting together at tables, we're trying to do all this, you know, carousing or whatever to make sure we get through what we get through. Then when you're voted in as a World Board member, there's a wall that goes up and you become a demo. And that was something that I was, and I don't think I've ever brought this up before except in hallways, but it's a really interesting phenomenon is because the RDs weren't inviting me out for coffee. The RDs weren't inviting me for lunch anymore, and it was immediate. And I became a them. I didn't want to become a them. I didn't put my hat in the ring to serve, to become a them. And then you experience, it seems the lower you get, or the higher on the pyramid, wherever we go, the more you are, you're the focal attention. People need to blame somebody for something. And sometimes it's the RD. I remember someone telling me when I was a regional delegate, you know, you've got to have pretty thick skin to do your job. And I thought, how unfortunate a statement is that? You shouldn't have to be thick-skinned to be a regional delegate. We should be celebrating our GSRs. We should be helping our GSRs, our committee chairs. We should be contributing to try and help them do their job better. But that statement really rubbed me the wrong way. Thank you. Is that my score? He just held up a 10 to tell me it was 10 minutes. Wow, I must be doing great. 5 minutes, I bet I'm going to go down to a 5. at any rate, I've done service at all sorts of different layers of Narcotics Anonymous, and it has been a humbling experience. The people that I serve with, the other members of the board, are just the most wonderful, caring, intelligent people I have ever had the opportunity to serve with, besides Ross. And, you know, it has been an amazing experience, and to try to tell you about what it's like, I hope everyone in this room gets the opportunity to do the job that I get to do, because it's to see the fellowship, to see the global, to see not only the global representation, but the global impact of working with the World Health Organization or the United Nations, or looking at getting into China and the different places and the different printing we have to set up, the explosion of the fellowship in Iran, getting to, you know, get the conventions in Barcelona, Brazil. it's amazing. I think one of my favorite moments on the board, because we have to travel. Everybody wants a board member to be there. There are events all over the world, and we would like a world board member there. We would like a world board member there. So we do have to travel quite a bit. And on one sunny afternoon in Victoria, I was driving with my wife, and the phone rang. And I picked it up because it wasn't illegal to talk on the phone then. And it was the chair. And he said, "What are you doing in April? And once again, I made the mistake of saying, "Nothing." He said, "Great, we need you to go to the Middle East." And I said, "What?" And my wife said, "No." And I said, "Wow, this is something else." Got to do what I love doing. Do what I really love doing is making a difference, and being on. And it's not just me making a difference. It's being on the team that makes a difference. Being there when changes happen. I flew into Cairo, met up with the rest of the SEAL Team 6, and we, you know, it was a whole. You get to see, like, Narcotics Anonymous is everywhere. It's everywhere. Every different language. Key fobs are the same color. Readings are the same color. It's everywhere. And, you know, to sit in a meeting in Kuwait and see someone get up, and you look around the room and everybody's wearing different clothes. I thought it was in a movie. And someone gets up to get that orange key fob, and he's crying his eyes out. And he's going, I can't understand what he's saying, but you know exactly what he's saying. You know exactly what he's saying. You don't have to know what he's saying. You know how he feels. And, you know, it was moving. We got a call from the Egyptian HNI, person in charge of HNI, and he had his card. He showed us his card. His card said, "President of the Message Carrier Society of Narcotics Anonymous." We said, "Yeah, you might want to change that." But he said, "Would you," it was myself and the chair, and we're both big HNI guys. We love HNI. He said, "Would you come and share in a men's prison?" It was a men, thank you, I'm almost done. It was a men's prison on the Persian Gulf. And we said, "Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, we'll have a translator for you. They're very excited. They love us in this prison." So Craig, who was the chair, and I, we got in this car, and we are driving through the streets. I don't know where it was. You just, you know, it's like a conveyor belt. You just get on it. It's been the best ride. We ended up arriving at this massive men's prison. The commandant or the general who ran it wanted to see us. So we went up with him. He had us up for tea and had pictures taken with him. He wanted pictures taken with us before we left. He told us how much he loved Narcotics Anonymous there. We love Narcotics Anonymous. We give them this room. It's all their room. We're going to give them another room because it's so popular in the prison. He said, "We read the Just for Today over the loudspeakers every morning for the entire prison." And when we got down to the room, it gives me goosebumps just talking about it now. When we got down to the room, there wasn't any room left on the wall or the ceiling. It was all covered with NA posters, NA memorabilia. There were speaker tapes in English that were scotch taped together because they'd been broken. I don't know whether they could understand them or not, but they would sit there and listen to them and look at the posters. And man, that experience of going in there, sharing, being part of the team, doing service, they gave us a replica of our symbol that they had made out of toilet rolls and string and elastic bands. It was about this big. We thought, how the hell are we going to get this on the plane? But of course, the prisoner really wanted to take a closer look at it before we took it out. But finally, you know, we got it out. But the whole experience is, you know, this is a big, big fellowship. It's a massive fellowship. And I don't think that enough people understand how important it is. How important it is to, I've gone down to a five. Oh, damn. So how important it is to do what we do. How important it is for there to be an activities chair. How important it is for there to be a GSR. How important it is for there to be somebody making coffee, if there's coffee at your meeting. Somebody to set up the chairs. Setting up the chairs was my first real service position. Because when I went into that first meeting, I saw these guys, I thought they had ADD, but they were setting up the chairs with the floor tiles. It had to be exactly 1.5 to 1.5. I said, I want to be on that team. I want to be on Team Obsession. So, you know, it doesn't matter what you do. There's a feeling of pride. There's a feeling of becoming part of the machinery, because this is our program. It's a we program. And to truly participate brings so much. I just can't tell you. And I've been very fortunate, very blessed to be allowed to do what I do and to be allowed to come and speak today. Thank you, guys. Hopefully you have another million years.
On behalf of Orkna 28, I would like to thank Ross and Arnie for sharing their experience, strength, and hope with us. Please join us in a circle to close this meeting with the we version of the Serenity Prayer.
everybody.